My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he would not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it's just like that. My name is Rob Mason, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Rob.
And by the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, excellent sponsorship, lots and lots of service work, and the program of recovery that I found in this book right here, I have not found it necessary to take a drink or anything that affects me from the neck up since the 7th of July, 1988. And for that, I am extremely grateful. And I want to thank the group here for inviting me to speak tonight. It is always an honor and a privilege for me. Anytime I get asked to do anything with this life-saving, life-changing, life-giving program. And I want to do a couple of things right from the beginning. First, I want to thank the new people. How about a round of applause for the new people tonight? We are so glad you're here. I am so grateful that you're here. Because I remember what it was like when I sat in my first 30 days. And I remember how out of place I felt and how uncomfortable it was. But what I didn't know is that my life was about to change, that I stood on the precipice of a change that I would never forget in the greatest journey that I'd ever embark on. I also want to apologize to the people in the front row. You'll understand why later. And I want you to know that there's two reasons that I'm here tonight. The first reason that I'm here tonight is because my God, the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, is a loving, powerful, and forgiving God. And He's so loving and powerful and forgiving that He can take something so broken and so flawed and so imperfect and do something powerful and meaningful even with that. And the second reason that I'm here tonight is I'm here because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to make it really clear from the beginning of my talk that you are looking at a guy that loves AA. I love meetings of AA. I love the fellowship of AA. I love the 12 steps of AA, right? I'm what's known as a card-carrying, banner-bearing, flag-waving, Kool-Aid-drinking member of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I'm enthusiastic about AA. I'm enthusiastic about the fellowship of AA. I'm enthusiastic about sponsorship. I'm enthusiastic about speaking at meetings like this. I'm enthusiastic about helping new people. I'm even enthusiastic about the word enthusiasm, if you really want to know the truth. Why? Because the word enthusiasm comes from Latin. The word theos, meaning God, and the prefix en, meaning within, the God within. And I believe that when I am enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous, I am expressing the God within. And somehow the God within me can hopefully touch the God within one of you. Just like when I talk to you and the God within you touches the God within me. And then we get to speak the great language of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get to speak the language of the heart. And hopefully something that I say here tonight for somebody that's new or maybe somebody that's been here can be useful. And if it is, please take it and use it. You know, if you're new and you're here tonight, the book Alcoholics Anonymous has some great news. It says on page 17 that the tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out upon which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Do you know what that means? It means if you're new here and nobody's ever told you before, you don't ever have to drink again. And I want to make it really clear. I'm not here tonight because I want to stay sober till my next AA birthday or Christmas or the 4th of July. I'm here for one reason and one reason only. I am here for permanent sobriety. And I know that there's a movement within Alcoholics Anonymous that says, well, we shouldn't talk about permanent sobriety. I don't know why. Our book talks about it. It says right in there in the foreword of the second edition, when Bill and Bob went to go help Bill Dodson, who was AA number 3, that this work indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent sobriety. And that's why I'm here. I'm here because I know what waits out there for me if I choose to pick up another drink. I try to talk to 2 people from the podium of AA, and only 2. First, I try to talk to people in their first year of sobriety. How many people here in their first year of sobriety? Show of hands. How about a hand for the people that are new? That's great. We're here for you, and hopefully that something that I say tonight will touch you. I also try to speak to people in their last year of sobriety. How many people here in their last year of sobriety? Well, now, you know, we laugh about that, right? But I think it's obvious that in any large group of alcoholics, there are going to be people in their first year, right? I think that's fair to say, right? But I think it's also fair to say in any large group of alcoholics that there are probably people in their last year, right? But isn't it interesting that the people in their first year know exactly who they are? We always talk about how screwed up the newcomer is, don't we? Oh, man, those newcomers, they're really screwed up. I was really screwed up when I was a newcomer, right? But I knew I was a newcomer. But what's interesting about that is the people who were in their last year, they have no idea who they are, do they? As a matter of fact, most of the time, everybody around them knows they're in their last year of sobriety except them, right? They're the last one to get the memo. As a matter of fact, if you know somebody with long-term sobriety who goes out and gets drunk, ask them this question when they finally make their way back. Say, would you have thought a week before you picked up your first drink that it was possible that you would get drunk, right? They'll always give you the same answer. And that is the cunning, baffling, and powerful nature of alcoholism. Is I never know when that day is going to come. And if I don't have an effective defense against the first drink, I'm sure to get drunk again. I try to do two things when I speak. Number one, I'm going to try to tell the truth. If you're anything like me, that in itself is an accomplishment. I'm the kind of guy, I've always told stories based in truth. Why? Because I've always wanted to impress you, right? But I want to make it real clear that I'm not here to impress you tonight. The second thing I'm going to try to do tonight is I'm going to try to carry the AA message. And I want to make it really clear that I'm not here tonight to carry my message. I'm not here to carry a message. I'm not even here to carry a great message. The 12th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous says, having had a spiritual awakening, which I have had, as the result of these steps, which I have taken, we tried to carry this message. What message? The message that as a result of the 12 steps, my obsession to drink has been removed. That as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a design for living that works. That as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am happily, usefully whole. That as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a life better than I could have ever imagined. And if that sounds good to you, if you're sitting here tonight and you've been here for 30 days or 60 days or 6 years or 16 years, and that sounds good to you, you're in the right place tonight. Because that's what we're going to talk about this evening. I was born in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco in the mid-1960s. Now, I don't think I need to tell anybody what was going on in the Haight-Ashbury in the mid-1960s, do I? I was a love child of the 1960s. My mother was 15 years old when I was born. I was born in a park in San Francisco. And my mother did the best that she could to take care of me. But she was 15 years old. So she couldn't take care of me because she couldn't take care of herself. So she did the only thing that she knew how to do. She took me and she gave me to the nuns, to the Sisters of Mercy at Catholic Social Services in San Francisco. And the nuns took care of me. They took care of me until I was finally adopted by my parents, the only family that I would ever know. And when I was a kid, we lived in the city of San Francisco. And as I got a little bit older, we moved to what's called the East Bay, out past Berkeley and that area, Oakland. And the eighth chapter of our book actually describes my home environment, how I grew up, perfectly. It says, if you live in the kind of house that I live in, you come from what they call a highly strained and abnormal condition, right? And you know what I found out when I got here? If you come from a highly strained and abnormal condition, guess what happens? You become a highly strained and abnormal person. And that's exactly what I became, right? Now, why do I talk about that? Because my childhood and how I was raised and how I grew up and the violence that happened in my house and the yelling and screaming and all the things that happened there had a lot to do with a lot of things. They had a lot to do with the fact that I wasn't a very good student. They had a lot to do with the fact that I was a social deviant. They had a lot to do with the fact that I was in trouble with the law before I was even a teenager. But the fact that I had a highly strained and abnormal condition in my home had absolutely, positively nothing to do with the fact that I became an alcoholic. You see, because if I believe what our book says that I suffer from a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession and a spiritual malady. It is not an environmentally induced condition. I've sponsored lots of people, taken over 300 people through the steps, men and women, young and old, gay and straight, black and white, right? Some of them had everything you could ever ask for. Some of them came from terrible situations of poverty and violence, right? But they all have one thing in common. they're all alcoholics, right? You see, my alcoholism is not induced by my environment. And similarly, because my alcoholism is not induced by my environment, I believe that my alcoholism cannot be treated by a change of environment, right? And I thought for a long time that what we did in Alcoholics Anonymous is we got what we call a little social therapy in the fellowship of AA, right? That we all got together like we are tonight and we all kept each other sober. And I'm here to tell you that I was mistaken about that. Because our book says that if you're an alcoholic of my description, that human aid alone, the fellowship itself, is insufficient to keep an alcoholic of my description sober. And I tried it again and again and again, which I'll talk about in a little while. Right. I remember when I was about 12 years old, I had something that would happen to me that would change the course of my life forever that I didn't even realize. All I can report about my growing up was this, is that I always somehow felt out of place. It always seemed, as my old sponsor Bob used to say, that there was all of you and then there was me. And it seemed to me like that I was on the outside of life looking in, right? I'm the guy that I've got to be twice as good as you just to feel average. Anybody here like that? Right? I got to be twice as good just to feel average, because if I'm just as good as you, I somehow feel inferior. And so I grew up that way, and I felt that way all of my life. I always felt like there was this insurmountable barrier between me and other people that I couldn't comprehend, I couldn't understand, and I couldn't overcome. And when I was 12 years old, I was out riding my bike around the schoolyard one day, and some older kids had taken a bottle of vodka from their father's liquor cabinet. And I remember they wanted me to take it. They thought it'd be kind of cute to get a 12-year-old kid drunk, you know? So they offered me some. And I wasn't sure I wanted to drink some of it, but I wanted to be cool and I wanted to fit in, right? So I took a big drink of it. And I hear people say, oh, I loved my first drink. I didn't like it at all, right? It burned down. It burned going back up. You know what I mean? And I took a big drink of it and I managed to swallow some of it, right? Because I didn't want to not look cool by spitting it out, right? And they passed this bottle around. It came back to me. I took another big drink of it, right? They passed it around again. It was about to come back to me. And I was about to say, no thank you, no more for me. I've had enough, when something magical happened. That our book describes as a sense of ease and comfort and peace and contentment that I had never experienced before. And I immediately went from being on the outside of life to feeling like I was inside for the first time. I went from feeling like I was two halves to being one whole for the first time in my life. And I loved that feeling. And I remember thinking, as that feeling washed over me, that I never want to feel the way I felt 5 minutes ago ever again. You know, I have a friend of mine who's also a member of our fellowship. His name is Jim. And Jim suffered from ADHD all of his life, right? Untreated and undiagnosed. And I remember we were out having coffee one day, not good if you have ADHD, by the way. We're out having coffee one day, and he was explaining to me about this ADHD that he'd suffered with. It had affected his school, his jobs, his relationships, his marriage. And he said, and I went to the doctor, and he prescribed this medication for me. He said, and Rob, I took this medication. And he said, it was almost as if all these voices that I had in my head all of my life got quiet for the first time. And I said, Jim, I understand, because that's exactly what happened to me when I took my first drink. All of the voices that I had in my head got quiet for the first time, right? And I loved that feeling, right? As a matter of fact, I got every promise that we read at the beginning of the meeting. I knew a new freedom and a new happiness, right? I didn't regret the pastor wished to shut the door on. I comprehended the word serenity, I knew peace. I saw how my experience could benefit others, right? I was like, I love you, man. Oh, man, I loved it, right? And if you're a drinker like me and you have alcoholism like I have it, and two or three drinks will do that for you, then the natural next question is, what will five or six drinks of alcohol do for me? I secretly suspected that I was about to be catapulted into what I like to call the fifth dimension of existence, of which I had not even dreamed, right? And I loved that feeling, right? And after that, what's interesting about that, and I didn't realize it at the time, but what's interesting is that after that, everything up until that point in my life, I was interested in a lot of things. I was interested in girls. I was interested in sports. I was interested in like a lot of other hobbies that I had and things that I was interested in. But after that, it was almost as if everything else in my life became secondary to that feeling that I got from taking a few drinks, because I loved it so much. And I would do anything that I could do and find a way to get that feeling back, right? The first few years of my drinking were fun. Why? Because I could control the damage. That's why, right? And I love that feeling. And so, as a matter of fact, I didn't finish the story. My first drunk, if you're anything like me, I ended up in a blackout. My first drunk, I ended up in the hospital with alcohol poisoning, choking up charcoal because I had alcohol poisoning, right? Ended up strapped down to the emergency room table, right? And you know what I found out later on? That's not social puking. That's not social puking, right? And most people would only do that once, but not me. Because I don't remember what alcohol does to me. I only remember what alcohol does for me. I only remember the sense of ease and comfort that I get that comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks that I see others taking, the book says, with impunity, which means without punishment, right? And so my best mate and me, Tom, we would do things that young people who drink too much do, right? And I thought he was like me for a long time. We seemed to drink a lot alike, right? So we would do things like we would go pick up girls, you know? That was fun to do. We would go into Berkeley. We would take the train into Berkeley, and we would walk up to People's Park and hang out with the hippies and do things that you do when you hang out with hippies in People's Park, right? Which is an outside issue, which we're not going to talk about, right? Okay? We did a lot of that, right? By the time I was 13 or 14 years old, I was doing robberies, right? I was 13 years old, and I would go into these liquor stores or grocery stores, and I was an undersized kid as it was, and I'd take this big jacket, and he would create a diversion, and I'd put bottles of Jim Beam and Jack Daniels and Southern Comfort in my jacket, and I'd walk right out the door. And nobody ever suspected it because nobody thought that a kid my age would do a thing like that, right? Because I had alcoholism, and they didn't understand that, right? But after only a few years of my drinking, I started to have some problems, right? I started, for example, to have some legal problems, right? I'm the kind of guy that, the best way I can describe it is I'm a cop magnet, right? I don't know how that happens to a guy like me, right? But I'm the kind of guy that I'll just be there minding my business and I'll walk around the corner and there'll be a cop there, right? And they always ask you these dumb questions, you know what I mean? Like, who are you and where are you going? What are you doing? You know what I'm saying? And I never had a good answer, so I would get arrested, right? And that started for me at a very, very early age. I started to have employment problems, right? I had to work to support my habit. Right? I had to find a job. I dropped out of high school by the time I was 15 years old, right? Because drinking was taking an exhilarating part in my life, right? And so I had to find work, and I had these unreasonable employers who didn't understand that once every couple of weeks, right around payday, I wasn't going to show up for 3 or 4 days, right? Because I would get paid, and I would have every intention of using that paycheck for my rent and for my bills and for my car payment, all those things. But on the way somehow home from picking up the paycheck till I did all those things, I got a great idea, right? And the great idea usually sounded something like, you know, you could go buy a few beers with this, and I'm sure it would take the edge off, would take some of that stress that you're feeling away, right? And I would end up on a 3 or 4 day bender, and I wouldn't know what happened. And I would come to or come out of a blackout somewhere, and I would drag myself back and beg for my job back. And they would give me my job back time after time, and then eventually they'd have to let me go. They say, Rob, listen, you're great when you're here, but you're too unreliable, right? We got to let you go. I started to have residential problems. I don't know if any of you have had that problem, right? You see, I would live from place to place, and I couldn't stay anywhere for too long, right? Because eventually people would get tired of my game, they'd get tired of my lies, they'd get tired of my story, right? And I would have to tell lies to cover up for the lies that covered up for the lies that I told before, right? And so I would start having problems, and I had nowhere to really go. And all of that would have been fine, but I started to have social problems, right? You remember that I'm the kind of guy that I drink to be on the inside of life. That's why I started drinking, to be a part of rather than apart from. But after only a couple of years of drinking, I started to have these problems. Because when I started drinking, people liked to be around me because everywhere I was, there was a party. But after only a couple of years of drinking, they started to not want to be around me because I was also the guy that they called the cops on. Right? I was the guy that threw up on your rug. I was the guy that hit on your wife. I was the guy that stole your stash and helped you look for it. I was that guy, okay? And I'm not proud of any of that stuff, okay? But that's the kind of guy that I was. And it always seemed to me like no matter how hard I tried, I was always more or less out of control. The reason that I qualify to be here is not because of how much I drank, although I drank a lot. The reason I qualify to be here is because I suffer from the illness that Dr. Silkworth describes with masterly detail in the doctor's opinion. Dr. Silkworth said that the alcoholic, once he starts drinking, develops this sort of allergy to alcohol, this phenomena of craving, that no matter how hard he tries, he can't stop once he starts. And that was always the case for me. Once I started, I could not predict what would happen, right? And he said, and coupled with that, they have some sort of mental obsession that their mind will convince them over and over again that it's okay to drink, that it's safe to drink, but somehow this time it's going to be different, despite countless vain attempts to prove that they could drink like other people, right? And that's what happened for me. Time after time, my mind would convince me that this time it was going to be different, and I would pick up a drink believing that I could do so, and then I would be out of control again, right? And this happened for me over and over. Incidentally, if you're not sure that you're one of us and you're new for the benefit of the new people, our book actually has a very simple two-question test on page 44 to determine if you're an alcoholic of our type. It says, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. That's the first question. I can't quit entirely. And that was always the case for me, right? I mean, I can quit drinking for a while, right? If I'm properly medicated, for example. I don't know about any of you, right? I mean, I can quit drinking for a while. Like, if I'm on the marijuana maintenance program, I can quit drinking for a while, right? And I know some people say that we shouldn't talk about drugs in Alcoholics Anonymous. Read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers on page 32, okay? Where Dr. Bob, the co-founder of our program, says that he took sedatives every day of his life for 20 years, so he never didn't take the morning drink, okay? You see, I'm not anything special. I'm just a real alcoholic. And I can quit drinking for a while, but I can't quit everything permanently, right? Or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take. And that was always the case for me, too. I could never control the amount that I tried to take, right? During the mid-80s, I made a lot of attempts to stop, right? I tried a lot of things. I tried religion. I was a Catholic after all, so I went to my parish priest, Father Bill. And he prayed with me, right? And he blessed me. Right? And secretly, just between us, I wanted to know where they kept the communion wine. That's what I was interested in, you know what I'm saying? And you know what I found out after Father Bill had tried to help me? Is he didn't understand alcoholism, right? He tried to help my spiritual malady, but he didn't understand my alcoholism, right? I tried psychiatry. As a matter of fact, I've been to more psychiatrists and psychologists than most people go to in their entire life. Spent thousands of dollars. And I love psychiatrists and psychologists. You know why? Because I get to pay you money and I get to talk about my favorite subject for an hour. That's why, right? And they didn't work for me either. They would work for a while, but they would say things like, Rob, you've got anxiety and low-level depression, right? And I thought for a long time my problem was depression, not alcoholism, because it looks like depression, right? But my problem, I found out later on, was spiritual in nature. And what I found out was that those psychiatrists and those psychologists, as much as they tried to help me, they didn't understand my alcoholism either, right? I tried treatment, right? As a matter of fact, don't get me wrong, anybody who's been to treatment, I think everybody should go to 3 or 4 treatment centers like I did. You know what I'm saying? I love treatment, you know? And the reason that I love treatment is because I can stay sober in treatment, right? I can stay sober for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days in treatment. But my problem is when I get out of treatment. And you know what I incidentally found out when I was in treatment, looking back in hindsight, is I don't think that the people who were treating me in treatment knew much more about my alcoholism than I did. Because they would say things that didn't make sense. They'd say, Rob, the reason that you're screwed up is because you drink too much, and now that you're here and you're not drinking too much, your life won't be so screwed up, right? And I would get 3 weeks away from what they told me the problem was, and I didn't get better. I actually began to get worse. Because if you're an alcoholic of my type, our book says that I don't get happy, joyous, and free when I abstain from alcohol. Our book says that I become restless, irritable, and discontented unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I would get away from alcohol for 2 or 3 weeks, and I would get this sense of impending doom, this sense of anxiety that I couldn't shake, this sense of wanting to kill myself that I couldn't understand. And what I didn't know then that I know now is that's because I had untreated alcoholism. And if you're anything like me and you suffer from the illness that I do, and you understand what I'm talking about, you know what it's like to suffer from alcoholism sober. So for a guy like me, really my alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. Because now I no longer have that thing to anesthetize my feelings, and I'm left just sitting there raw with all of this garbage that I don't know how to deal with and all these feelings that I've never learned how to take care of. And all of this insecurity and fear and guilt that I have that I didn't know what to do with. And the book says that this is repeated over and over again. I'm the kind of guy that I will stay sober as long as I can until I have to get drunk because I can't stand it another minute. And then I would get drunk. And I would stay drunk as long as I could until I had to get sober. Because you can't stay sober, you can't stay drunk forever. Eventually your body will give out and you'll have to get sober. And that happened to me time after time after time. The last 2 years of my drinking were like hell. That's the best way I can describe it. The party was over, right? The unfortunate part is everybody got the memo except me. I was the last one to get the memo, right? I had wrung all the fun out of it, right? I tried to stop drinking, right? And I had alienated everybody that I ever known or cared about in my life, right? I had become what's called a violent, reclusive, suicidal, self-destructive alcoholic, right? And I would go on these crying jags, these jags of alcoholic depression. I would end up in blackouts and wake up and come out of a blackout in places that I didn't know, places that I didn't know I'd even been. I still get reminded by my brother and my family of things that they say I did that I still have no recollection of to this day. My brother reminds me of a time he says that we went to Chinatown in San Francisco and I came running out of this building and two Chinese guys came out and were shooting at us as he was driving away in the car. I have no recollection of. My friend Tony was murdered in a drug deal during this time, right? I fell out of a moving car a couple of times, right? And as a result of all of that, I was forced to do something about my problem, although I didn't know what I was going to do. And somehow I believed every single time that I picked up a drink, I believed it was going to be different. And I hear people say, well, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. That wasn't insanity for me. Insanity for me was knowing every single time that it wasn't going to be any different, but having no power to do anything else, doing it anyway, right? You know, our book, we talk about denial a lot in AA, right? And incidentally, our book doesn't use the word denial at all. It describes it a little bit in the doctor's opinion about this idea of denial. But our book actually talks about something even worse than denial. It talks about self-delusion. And the best definition of self-delusion I ever heard was self-delusion is where you want something to be a certain way so badly you actually convince yourself it is that way, even though it's not. And that's a perfect description of the last 2 years of my drinking. You see, because I can't imagine my life with alcohol, but I can't imagine my life without it either. I was introduced to AA in the early 80s through a treatment center that I was in. As a matter of fact, the worst years of my drinking came after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, right? And I remember, and back in those days, in the early 80s, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, there wasn't anybody within 10 or 15, 20 years of my age at any of the meetings that I was. It's not like today where you go in, there's people in their 20s and 30s in meetings. I mean, I remember I went in like 1982. I got out of this treatment center. I'm like 15 years old, right? And I went to this meeting and there was these old pasty-faced old guys at this meeting. And I walked into the meeting and they said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm here for the AA meeting. They said, you're too young to be an alcoholic. I went, you're right. Out I went. You know what I'm saying? They confirmed what I already knew. You know? I mean, I used that for like 3 or 4 years. Yep, I went to AA. They said I was too young. You know what I'm saying? And I said, so obviously I can't be an alcoholic. It's funny how things come full circle, right? Now I go to AA meetings and I introduce myself and they go, man, that guy looks too young to have 26 years of sobriety. And I love that too. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I applied this program to my life, right? I was the worst kind of newcomer. I will tell you that right now. I spent 6 years coming in and out of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I belong to one of the two groups that our book says will not make it. It says those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Not my simple program, not a simple program, not one simple program, not some simple program, but this simple program. And I tried everything else, right? I tried everything. I looked everywhere else to find a solution to my problem. And I was unable to find my solution, right? Alcoholics Anonymous was the last house on the block for me. And I was the worst kind of, you know what the worst kind of newcomer is? The worst kind of newcomer is the guy who's been around AA for a little while, right? So he knows all the lingo. He knows the jargon, right? He knows the things to say, right? But he knows it up here, right? He doesn't know it in here. And you know what I found out? Knowing is not it. It's not about knowing, right? Knowing is like reading the menu. You can starve to death reading the menu. It's about doing, right? And I was the guy that I thought I knew a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, so nobody could tell me nothing, right? I was what my first sponsor used to call the I know guy, right? He'd say, do this. I go, yeah, I know, right? Or do that, or here's something to think about. Yeah, I know that, right? And as a result of that, I couldn't do anything, right? I recently heard somebody say something that described me perfectly. He said, when I came to AA, right? He said, if you picture your life like a big pie chart like this, right? He said, science tells us we only use 10% of our brain, 10%. Right? He said, so we'll say that there's 10% of that pie chart and that's what we know. Right? He said, then there's about 20% of that pie chart, and that's what we don't know, right? And the other 70% is that's what we don't know that we don't know we don't know, right? And that's a perfect description to me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what I didn't know, right? And what I found out after coming around here for 6 years of being unsuccessful to get a foothold here is that Alcoholics Anonymous works best when we're out of ideas. And I came in here with a lot of ideas, and they all had to be smashed before I could accept the program of AA. There was a detox near where I was staying, and I would show up there intermittently trying to get 3 or 4 days together, believing that if I could get 3 or 4 days together that somehow my life would change, right? And I would show up there, and I would say every time I left, I'd say, I'm never coming back here again, right? And I meant it every single time. You could have put me on a lie detector, it would have said I was telling the truth, right? But I always seemed to end up back there. My eyes would come open and there I would be in the detox again, wondering how I got there again. And I would stay there and I'd swear this time it was going to be different because this time I had a plan. Not like that faulty plan I had last time. This time I've got a better plan. And I'm going to get a job and I'm going to be the kind of son I should be. And I'm going to be responsible. And I'm going to go say I was sorry to those people that I hurt. And I'm going to do the right thing. And I'd get about 3 or 4 days out of detox, and my head would say, this time it's going to be different. Last time it was those guys you were hanging out with. Last time it was that vodka you were drinking. Last time it was that tequila that you drank. Last time it was that you got in the car and started driving. And it would tell me that lie over and over again, and I would begin drinking, believing that I could do so. And I would end up in the same situation in a very short time. I probably would have killed myself during this time. But God has an interesting way of intervening in our life, doesn't he? Right? And I remember my last drunk came at an unsuspected time. I would not have imagined. Came on the 4th of July weekend of 1988. Now, I would have picked a better weekend. As a matter of fact, if somebody had told me this is going to be your last drunk, I'd have drank another week, right? Because I'm just like that, right? But I didn't know it was my last drunk, and it started out much like any other weekend was for me around that time. I woke up that Saturday morning determined not to drink, but I knew in my heart it was only a matter of time. You see, I knew from my experience that I was a loser and a failure and that I would end up drunk again, right? But I swore to myself that morning I wasn't going to drink. And about noontime, I got this, what I call this alcoholic started in, right? And the alcoholic said things like, well, you know, it's a holiday, and so really technically it doesn't count. And really, after all, what kind of good American wouldn't celebrate his country's birthday by having a few drinks, right? Makes sense, right? Okay. So I started having a few beers, and just about that time, as coincidence would have it, the one person that still talked to me called me up on the phone. He said, hey, we're going to have a little 4th of July get-together. There's going to be some girls there. We're going to have some drinking. It's going to be fun. And I thought, that's exactly what I need. I need some girls, some drinking, and some fun, right? Because I'm so depressed, and I feel so down, right? And so the last thing I remember is getting to this little 4th of July get-together and finding a bottle of vodka. And I remember consciously my hand reaching out and grabbing it like that, and that's the last thing I remember. The next thing I know, I came out of a blackout, and I'm strapped down in the hospital emergency room again, and I've peed my pants and thrown up all over myself again, and I have charcoal coming out of my nose and my mouth again, and my teeth are missing on this side. I got a big gash over my forehead, and all I wanted to know is had I been arrested, because if I'd been arrested, it was a violation of my probation. I was going down for 2 years. And I'm strapped down in the hospital emergency room. They filled me in later that apparently I'd picked a fight with the biggest guy at this get-together. And I call it a fight. He just kind of beat the hell out of me pretty much, right? And so somebody put me in their car to take me home, right? People always trying to help alcoholics out, right? And so he's taking me home. And apparently at some point during the car ride home, I got in an argument with the driver, right? So I decided I was going to get out of the car, which would have been fine. But the car was going 35 miles an hour when I stepped out of the car, right? So I ended up face down in the gutter. Luckily, I didn't get killed, got run over and got killed. And along comes the ambulance, and they take me to the hospital, none of which I remember. And I come out of this blackout, strapped down in the hospital emergency room. And I'm laying there, and I had a moment of clarity. And a moment of clarity is where God paralyzes your ego for just a minute that you can see the truth for the first time. And my ego got paralyzed, and I saw the truth. And as I laid there, I realized that I'd woken up that morning determined not to drink. And this realization hit me. I said, my God, I'm an alcoholic. I'm the guy that they've been describing for 6 years. And I got it. I got it for the first time. And I owned it. And as I laid there, I said, what am I going to do? I didn't know what to do. I had nowhere left to go, right? And they kept me there for a few days. I was beat up pretty bad. And eventually they let me go. And I remember as those hospital doors opened, those glass doors opened, I remember the first thought that came to my mind, and if you're an alcoholic like me, this thought will come to you, even though you've admitted complete defeat. I thought to myself, who am I going to have to lie to, cheat, or steal from to get four bottles, to get a bottle of Gilby's gin? Right? And I realized something. I realized that there wasn't one single person I could call who wanted to hear from me. Right? There wasn't anybody left. My parents didn't want to see me. My friends didn't want to see me. And I said, well, I guess there's nowhere left for me to go. Where can I go? And then I remembered that there was one place where I could go that they would be happy to see me. I said, well, I guess I'll go back to Alcoholics Anonymous one last time. Even though I know it doesn't work, I'll go. So I walked. I took the bus. And I walked in the doors of the Concord Fellowship for what I know can be the last time. And I went to AA for the last time, beaten and defeated and hopeless, one more time. And on the 7th of July, 1988, a miracle happened for me. And it came in the form of a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And on that day, I became the victim of excellent sponsorship in our program. And my sponsor was one of those right-wing AA enthusiasts who did not put up with my drabble or listen to what I wanted to say. He insisted that I do things that he knew in his wisdom would be good for me that I could not see. And if you're lucky, you will have a sponsor that will do the same thing for you rather than letting you die because he doesn't want to hurt your feelings by asking you to do things that you don't want to do. And he shared with me some valuable information that's responsible for the fact that I'm your speaker tonight. He said, Rob, I've been watching you for months come in and out and in and out of here. And the way I see it, you've got two choices. You can have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps and stay sober, or you can continue to drink and you are going to die of alcoholism. He said, but suppose I could show you a way of life infinitely better than the life that you have today. Suppose I could show you a way of life where you never have to feel the way you're feeling right now ever again. Suppose I could show you a way of life where you never have to pick up another drink of alcohol. Would that interest you, son? I said, yes, sir. He said, then we have a program of recovery for you. He said, if you can't handle your drinking and you can't handle your sobriety, then Alcoholics Anonymous is for you. And my wise sponsor began to ask me to do things that I didn't understand. I didn't understand at all, but that he knew would help me, right? And he said things to me like, Rob, we have a 10:30 meeting here at the Concord Fellowship, and I want you to be there every night because I go to that meeting, right? And he said, do you have a big book? I said, I do. He said, well, I want you to read it, and in there are 12 steps of recovery, and we're going to work those 12 steps. He said, and for God's sake, Rob, quit being an asshole. Nobody around here likes you because you're kind of an asshole, right? And I said, well, that 10:30 candlelight meeting, that's a little late for me, you know. And I'm not really a big reader. I said, I can do some of that stuff. He said, well, that's the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, Rob. You don't have to like it. You don't have to understand it. You don't have to agree with it. But if you want to stay sober, you have to do it, right? And I could understand that. And so I began to work these steps under the direction of my sponsor, right? I had to become a yes man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to become willing to do the deal, right? You know what I found out a little bit later on? Is AA doesn't accept draftees. It only accepts volunteers. And I was the kind of guy that I'd been around AA for 6 years, right? I was involved in AA. But I found out there's a difference between being involved in AA and being committed to AA, right? And I needed to become committed. If you don't know the difference, here's the difference, right? Yesterday morning, I went out and had breakfast with John. John, I went out and had breakfast. I had my favorite breakfast, right? I had eggs and sausage, my favorite breakfast. Now, the chicken that laid those eggs, he was involved in that breakfast, right? But the pig that made that sausage, he was committed, right? And I had to become a committed member of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It wasn't good enough for me to just be an alcoholic from 8 to 9 p.m. I had to be an alcoholic all the time. I wasn't sober very long, and my wise sponsor said, you know what, you've been sober long enough. I think you're ready to have a job in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I said, oh, my God. He said, so tomorrow night I want you to show up early. You're going to be the chairman of the meeting. I thought, oh, my God. I didn't even know the hierarchy in AA, right? I figured I was moving up the ranks, and pretty soon I'd be president of AA, you know? And so I showed up extra early than me. I didn't have a job at that point. So I remember watching the clock tick by, the hours tick by. I got there extra early. I said, okay, I'm here extra early. What does the chairman do? He said, you see all those chairs right there? Put them around the room, right? And I'm putting these chairs around the room, right? Secretly feeling debased. Secretly feeling like this is below me, right? But you know what? What I realize now that I didn't know then is that my sponsor didn't give me jobs in AA that were up to my intellectual level. He gave me jobs that were up to my emotional level. And I was like a child. And so he gave me jobs that would make me feel useful and make me feel a part of AA. And so I was putting those chairs around the room. And the interesting thing began to happen. So I'm putting the chairs around the room, and I would meet people in the fellowship, in the meeting room, right? That I was too shy to go introduce myself to, right? And then they'd say, well, who are you? And I'd introduce myself. And by the time I'd done that job for like 3 weeks, I knew everybody in the club. And they knew me, right? And in my sponsor's weird way of thinking, he thought that that would make me feel a part of, and he was right. And eventually, I got to be a coffee maker. I got to lead a meeting, right? As a matter of fact, if you stay around here long enough, mark my words. Pete and Liesl will attest to this. You stay around here long enough, right? You'll work your way all the way down to servant, right? And all the geniuses will be in the back seat of your car. You'll be taking them off to Kissimmee to hear some schmuck speak, right? Okay. Incidentally, the Big Book doesn't tell us how to stay sober. It tells us what to do to stay sober, right? And I began to work these steps under the direction of my sponsor. My sponsor said to me some things like, well, do you understand the first step? I said, yeah, I got the first step, right? He said, oh, really? He said, well, if you understand it so well, why don't you explain it to me? So if you're new and your sponsor asks, do you understand something, just say no. It's a trick, okay? Just say no. It's a trick. He said, so why don't you explain it to me? I said, well, sure. I said, step one says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, therefore our lives have become unmanageable. He goes, wrong. That's not what step one says. He says, step one says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That means you can't handle your drinking. He said, can you handle your drinking? I said, no. He said, that's why you're here in this meeting, because you can't handle your drinking. If you could handle your drinking, you'd be out of handling your drinking. He said, then there's a dash. He said, you see that little dash? And I had to admit I had not seen that little dash, right? He said, that means end of one thought, beginning of a new thought, that our lives had become unmanageable. He said, you know what that means? It means that you can't handle your sobriety either. He says, so step one, section A says, I can't handle my drinking. Then there's a dash. Step one, section B says, I can't handle my sobriety contented either. If you could handle your drinking, you'd be out drinking. If you could handle your sobriety, you'd be out handling your sobriety. The reason that you're here in this meeting is because you can't live successfully in either world. Step one, he said, is a twofold admission of defeat. I can't live successfully in either world. He said, you know what, Rob? We have a name for that. I said, what is it? He said, we call that alcoholism, right? He said, people that don't have alcoholism, that are just hard drinkers that are described on page 21 of our book, they stop drinking, their life gets better, they live a powerful, manageable life. Some people can only have to be once born, but guys like you and me, we have to be twice born in the third step in order to live a harmonious life. For the new people, we know that these steps look like punishment, but really they're the pathway to freedom. Just like we know that alcohol looks like the pathway to freedom, but it's really punishment. And I spent a lot of time doing things that were mistakes in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I looked for everywhere else for relief, right? I spent a lot of time worried about what other people think, right? Like I'm looking around the room and some people are worried about if I'm going to end on time, and I'm not, okay? I'll tell you that right now, okay? Okay? But I spent a lot of time worried about what other people thought, right? And you know what I found out? I spent a lot of time, even in AA, worried about my reputation, right? Maybe some of you here worry about your reputation in AA, right? Okay. But you know what my sponsor told me? He said, Rob, you don't need to worry about your reputation. As a matter of fact, John referenced it in his talk. When I got divorced 3 years ago, my AA reputation took a hit. Because unfortunately, there were some people that were going around AA saying things like, that Rob Mason, he's a liar and a cheat and a thief. He's a terrible husband and a terrible person, right? And I wanted to defend myself. My sponsor said, you don't need to defend yourself. Because there's people who are going to believe that, and those are the people you don't need in your life anyway. He said, you know what? Our sixth and seventh step talks about something other than our reputation. It talks about our character, right? And he promised me something. He said, if you take care of your character, I promise you your reputation will take care of itself, right? So I don't worry so much about what people think anymore, right? I spend a lot of time trying to do the wrong thing to feel good, right? If I do the wrong thing, I'll get to feel good, right? I mean, that doesn't even make sense when I hear myself say it, right? But I want to do bad to feel good, right? And you know what I found out after a while in these rooms? Is if I want to feel good, I got to do good. If you do good, you feel good. And if you do bad, you feel bad. And if you're sitting here tonight and you feel worthless and useless, try this. Real concept for people like us. Stop doing worthless things and see what happens. Right? I remember when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a problem with God, right? Like me having a problem with God is going to bother God somehow, right? You know? And I said, well, I'm not sure if I believe in God. And if there is a God, I'm screwed, so I might as well not believe in him. My sponsor said, that's okay. Why don't you just live like there is a God and just see what happens? Just see what happens, right? And so I started to apply some spiritual principles to my life. And so these steps, you know, we take these steps and we're rendered sober, right? And you'd think that it'd be smooth sailing from there. I took the steps. I was rendered sober. Compulsion to drink left. I forgot to mention that. I did my fifth step in a park in Concord, California in August of 1988, right? I went and I shared my inventory with my sponsor. And I shared everything with them, right? Even the stuff I didn't want to share, right? And the thing I can report from that is that from that day till this day, I have never again had a compulsion to drink, right? My compulsion to drink was removed, and in my case, it's never returned. And I know that as long as I do certain simple things, I never have to drink again. So, you know, you'd think it would be smooth sailing. Unfortunately, as my grand sponsor, who some of you know, Clancy says, he says, no matter how good any of us get or how long we're sober, none of us ever rises above human being, right? We're all fallible and, you know, subject to misery and depression sometimes, wanting to do things our way. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our trouble, right? And I'm victim to that sometimes too. And all I've got to do is just get off the beam a little bit, right? And stop doing the things that keep me well, right? And all of a sudden I become the center of my own world. But interestingly enough is when I become the center of my own world again, right? Instead of all of you being the center of my world and AA being the center of my world, I don't feel like I'm screwed up, right? But I think everyone around me is screwed up because all of you start to look really screwy, right? And I think it's my job to straighten you out. I think that I'm like the guy in the army, that I'm marching with everybody and I look around and I go, look, everybody else is out of step. That's me, you know what I'm saying? When I'm screwed up spiritually. Because I have a spiritual malady. And one of the things that you'll notice if you see somebody that goes out, because I've become a student of relapse, right? Because there's two things you learn in AA. You learn what to do and you learn what not to do, right? And I don't want to get drunk, right? Last year I buried three people that I knew, right? But if you watch people that relapse, you'll actually watch them take the steps in reverse, right? You'll see them, they stop working with other alcoholics. They stop prayer and meditation. They stop doing that daily inventory, right? They stop making amends when they've harmed someone, right? They stop asking God to remove their defects. They stop sharing their inventory honestly with their sponsor, right? They stop turning their will over each day to a God of their understanding, right? And then what happens? The book says the insanity of alcohol returns and they drink again, right? And that can happen to any of us, right? It could happen to me, maybe you. As I said in my introduction, I think it's fair to say that in any large group of alcoholics that could happen. I buried a friend of mine, some of you knew Kevin, a couple of years ago, and that was Kevin's problem. You know, I remember the fateful day that he called me to tell me that he'd grown beyond sponsorship, right? He said that he'd grown beyond sponsorship, that God was going to be his sponsor. And I remember telling him the fateful words. I said, Kevin, well, I hope you talk to somebody because AA is full of smart guys like you. And unfortunately, most of them end up dead. And he ended up dead, right? And I didn't want to be right about that, but I've seen it too many times in here. You know, I'm not a guy that I believe in sponsorship. My sponsor leads me in a direction that I'm unable to go myself. And the job that I have with the people that I sponsor is to teach them what I call the habits of survival. John's heard them many times. To encourage them to be involved in the society of AA, to develop a spiritual program, to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, to be involved in sponsorship as being sponsored and sponsoring others, and then finally to be of service to the people around me in every area of my life, right? You know, it's funny. We always talk about being closer to God. You know, one of the things that I believe is that God, if God is infinite, then that means he's too big for me to contain him, right? But you know what our program says? Our program says that when I'm helping you, somehow I get to feel God's power flow through me. In my business, we talk about flow through. And flow-through is where you have top-line revenue and what flows to the bottom line. And the same is true in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is the closest that I ever find that I get to God is when I'm trying to help that new person. Or when I'm up here speaking to all of you trying to help somebody in this room. And I can feel the power of God flowing through me, right? Our book talks about practicing these principles in all of our affairs. I remember I was about 5 years sober, and I took up the game of golf. Maybe so. Anybody in here a golfer? Any golfers in here? If you want to learn a lesson in frustration and love and tolerance, take up the game of golf, okay? Because I'm not a natural. As a matter of fact, I had a problem with my golf game, for those of you who don't know. Is I was a very good baseball player. You know, I was actually could have been a pro baseball player at one point, right? Until my alcoholism took over, right? And the problem with that is you'd think that there are skills that are transferable from baseball to golf, right? I thought there were, right? But what I found out pretty quickly is that a golf swing is like this, and a baseball swing is like this, right? And so I would get out there on the golf range, and I would hit these beautiful shots, but I would turn my wrists over like that, right? Like a baseball swing. So the ball would go out like that, and it would go like that, right? And I knew what the problem was in my mind, right? I knew what the problem was. I'm turning my wrists over, the ball's going like that, right? So I got this golf coach, right? And he would come out there to the range with me, right? I'm a real alcoholic here, right? I got this golf coach to help me, right? And he would correct my swing, right, to try to correct this problem. The problem remained. I would watch videos on the problem, right, to try to fix the problem, right? I would read books on how to correct your golf swing, but the problem persisted, right? But every once in a while, I would get out there and I would hit this shot and it would be a perfect shot, right? And that would keep me going for the next couple days, right, to try to hit another perfect shot, right? But my golf coach said something that I've always applied to step 12 of our program, right, that really for me is the essence of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. He promised me something. He said, Rob, I promise you this, that if you will get out here and practice your golf swing day after day, right, then the glorious day will come where what you know in your mind and your actions will be in harmony. And I'm here to tell you my experience in my brief 26 years in this fellowship, for those of you who are new, is if you will apply this program and you will practice it on a daily basis, then the day will come, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, when the glorious day will happen that what you know in your mind and your actions will be in harmony. You know, we talk about the promises of our program. We read them at the beginning of the meeting, right? And we always say, are these extravagant promises? And everybody goes, we think not, right? Okay. I incidentally, sometimes when I read the big book, I read it with a dictionary there. So one day I looked up the word extravagant. And do you know what the word extravagant means? It means undeserved grace or favor. You know? Now, I don't know about you, but if you're the kind of alcoholic like I am, is receiving the promises that come halfway through the ninth step for a guy like me undeserved grace or favor? You bet it is, right? And incidentally, the most important part of those promises comes after that. It says they are being fulfilled among us sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. My early sponsor, Pappy Carl, used to say, that means, Rob, that we do the tangible and we let God do the intangible. We do the possible, we let God do the impossible. John Wesley, the founder of the United Methodist Movement, put it this way. He said, without God, I cannot, but without me, he will not. If you're new and you're wondering what the secret to sobriety is, you know, I thought for a long time there must be some secret to sobriety that some of you knew and the rest of us didn't know, because I couldn't get a foothold in here. And for the benefit of those of you who are new, we have a secret to sobriety. And it took me 6 years coming in and out to figure it out. And the way we keep it a secret is we read it at every single meeting. That's how you keep it a secret in AA, right? It's the part where they say, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. That's the secret, right? And I would make a couple observations. Number one, they don't suggest anything else, do they, right? Nope, the only thing they suggest is here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number two, if I don't have the 12 steps, then I don't have a program of recovery, do I, right? It doesn't say here are the steps we took which are part of a program of recovery, no. It says here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. And if that's true, then I would submit this to you in closing, right? I remember my early sponsor saying to me, Rob, you've been coming around the fellowship of AA for 6 years. He said, is that right? I said, yes. He said, and you've never worked the AA program, have you? I said, no, I have not. He said, that means you're not really doing AA. And Rob, if you're hanging around the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're not doing the AA program, let me ask you a question. What are you doing? Right? What are you doing? You know, I early in sobriety, and I'll end with this. I wanted to know what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is really about. I remember going to Carl. I said, Carl, what is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous about? Is it about getting a great job and having a great wife and, you know, having a great life? He said, no, it's not about that at all. It's not about that at all. As a matter of fact, they asked Bill Wilson once, what could you describe the program of AA? He said, AA is a program. He said, it's utter simplicity wrapped in a complete mystery. Right? My sponsor said it a little bit differently. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not about getting the things of this world. We talk about worldly clamors. Bill talks about worldly clamors in his story. That's, all that means is where the things of the world are more important than the things of the Spirit. He said, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is very simple. It's about loving God and serving Him and your fellows. And as a result of doing that, you get to be purposeful and useful, and you get to be relatively and reasonably happy in this world and infinitely happy in the next. And that's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is about. You know, I've gotten everything that I ever wanted and nothing I ever expected, all by taking actions that I didn't agree with. And tonight, I have some great news. You can too. Thank you.